It's Ken Bergen here, and welcome to the Hospo Reset podcast. Each episode, I explore trends, innovation, and smart thinking in the hospitality industry with a particular focus on restaurants, cafes, and food service. You'll find the show notes and links for today's episode on your podcast app and look for the link at the top of the hosporeset.com website. Don't forget to subscribe to the weekly Hospo Reset newsletter and connect with me on LinkedIn and on Twitter. Hi, it's Ken Bergen here from Hospo Reset podcast. Today I'm talking to Michael Tingsayer from the Hospitality Mavericks podcast. So it's two podcasters talking together, and we're talking about innovation and leadership in hospitality management. That might sound just a little bit vague, but I think you find that we're going to dig quite deep into all the things that Michael's been learning from the research and the many people he talks to in hospitality. Well, last time I checked, he was up to episode number 156 of his podcast, and there's always there's a lot of hospitality podcasts around now, aren't there? And a lot of them are based on biography, finding innovative people and successful operators and telling their story, and it can be interesting. But Michael's angle seems to be a little bit more looking at kind of business leaders and business experts and business founders, and digging a little deeper. I really enjoy it, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. You might want to tune in if you're not already. He's based in the UK, and he has a really great perspective on the industry, obviously in the UK, in Europe, Danish by origins, North America and worldwide. Michael, great to have you here today.
Lovely to be here. I'm humbled and honored, Ken, to be on your show. You are a seasoned podcast. I can't remember how many episodes I interviewed on my show, and I looked into how many episodes you did. Was it close?
Yeah, my previous podcast, Profitable Hospitality, we got to 300. Yeah, that's not around now, but I have the podcast itch, so I started again.
Well, I'm running a marathon, so hopefully one day I can hit that milestone as well. We have interviewed 200 leaders now, exactly, in total. And it's a very humble and experience and learning experience, as you said.
So you're it's a bit of a cliche. I'd say you are in a position of thought leadership, really, from the work you do. And you've got your background is deep in hospitality. Just give us an outline of how you got to where you are now and where you started and the first dishes you carried and how that all developed.
So yeah, that's a long story. So we'll make it as short as possible. But the key thing here is that, as you said, I'm fascinated and also obsessed student of trying to figure out why some organizations outperform others and outlather no matter the condition. But it will be Fantastic. There no matter what. And we just had a pandemic, and I think has been a great example of, and it's not just in hospitality, but in general, that came very early on. But the hospitality comes because I was born into a hospitality family. And from day one, I was with my mom in her restaurants or pubs or cafes and different things we had. And very early, I started working in my mom's in that business. And I had my own little sausage trailer, as we called them in Denmark, while selling sausages out on a Saturday and earning the money I want to spend on a stereo or whatever I wanted, I did there. And then when I was 15 years old, my mom said, it's time to leave the family business. And my mom, she had some back issues. She wanted to sell some of it up, and she had a good person in her network locally, in the business network, that was opening McDonald's called Paul. And my mom had already filled in the application. There was nothing to do. I had to go to the interview.
Just turn up.
And I was not a big fan of it because I really didn't want to leave the family business, because I only been to McDonald's once. I didn't have really had an understanding of what McDonald's was or anything. This is the early 90s. But I got the job and I started cleaning the loos. And yeah, my mom is always right, isn't she? So I ended up spending more than 11 years with McDonald's, running restaurants and going into head office both in Denmark and the UK in different positions, especially in HR, training, operations, and so on, and technology. And also spent a very big time after McDonald's period in a Danish cafe chain. Was more in the entrepreneurial end of thing. It was not an established corporate business, But I came out with my corporate experience, I thought, and I wanted to help entrepreneurial businesses to lift their foundation, because I understood I've been very lucky to be in one of the most high performing organizations in the world, not just in restaurants. But I had to learn a lot, but I was very lucky to be part of a Danish cafe chain that was a bit more around the coffee revolution in the early 2000s. And we grew that from 4 units to a plus 20 unit cafe chain, built on principle.
So coming from such a successful template with McDonald's, what were some of the things with this group, with their four, starting with four, and obviously kind of young and making a few mistakes and experimenting? Yeah. What were some of the things that stood out as kind of early big challenges and successes?
It became very, very quickly clear to me as I progressed very quickly up to that organization, became responsible for operations and people and the day-to-day running of the business, that you couldn't copy the McDonald's template. You had to find your own. At that point, I didn't know it was all about the purpose, the vision, the culture. I found out as I started working with a guy called Kai Vogtmann, who is a professor in organizational design at that point. And I actually had him at my university, and he came in and helped me really trying to understand. I need to create a different identity for myself and the business.
So you had to be kind of a different kind of person as well.
Yeah. And he gave me a book, and it's followed me. I talked about it on the podcast there many times. It's called Good to Great by Jim Collins.
Yeah.
And it's this book about, again, coming back to the question I've been pursuing, is like, because I was very lucky to get this in my early 20s, why is some organization doing better than others? And it came down to they were very good at building a very strong foundation, a very consistent organization that was very not built on a technology or an idea or a product. It was built on the soul of the business, the leaders' qualities, the culture's quality, and the employee experience quality. And it's a great book, and it's still relevant, and it's built up by data. It's a big data research. So it's not like anecdotal. As many management books become, they become very anecdotal. This is like real data, Jim Collins and his research team from Stanford, without confirming. So that became his big passion, and using that book of 9 years to build this chain from the bottom up. But what we really got wrong, even though we had that very early on, I learned that, was the people bit, because we scale so fast that our people capabilities was not connected with what we needed, actually. And we lost some good people because we lost contact with them. So again, the whole growth paradigm was challenged in a way. And we moved the business back again to a smaller business that functioned better, because we were gone past what the culture could do.
You actually shrank the business, did you? Yeah, interesting.
And that was a very different mindset than McDonald's, where the thing is that how many openings can you fill in on a certain square meter of a country? And McDonald's couldn't do that from day one. And I think that's one of the learnings. I think we might, even in the new era of hospitality, we might come back to that, still haven't thought really about one of the things that really learned me in early age, that growth is not always good. It can actually also be bad, because it can kill profitability.
Yeah, great, great point. And I think of my own example. I had a very successful cafe, loved it, really good. And you almost have this entrepreneurial itch. Like, and people say to you, when are you going to do another one? What's the next one? And you almost feel like you've got to duplicate. And the second one was just hard. It was, the first one was neglected, and then you've got to be, just kind of learning scale. And then there was a third one, and then gradually I scaled back to one as well. But that was my little tiny example. But I think that itch to grow just for the sake of it is a pretty strong one with a lot of people.
Yeah, and I think it's also so sometimes, Ken, that you're given opportunities, because that was what happened for us, because we were good at something and we were doing really well, and we had that really strong foundation from a very entrepreneurial place, definitely to go to 10 and units, was that we were given opportunities suddenly. We were given opportunities by landlord. We think we have to act.
They're knocking on your door all the time, aren't they? Yeah, with amazing rental deals.
And at that point, I unfortunately hadn't read Danny Meyer's great book, Setting the Table, and studied Danny Meyer. And he would have said, it's more about what you say no to than what you say yes to. And Good to Great actually says that, but we totally ignored that.
Yeah.
Because
You'd missed that chapter.
We learned it in the hard way. And I think it's really interesting when everybody talks about now coming back after the pandemic and growing businesses again and opening units. I don't know why that is important. I guess it's like important to make very individual profitable units, because if you look across your portfolio, there's some of your units probably eat the profit.
Yeah, well, I think people are looking at their product mix as well. I saw someone recently in a forum and he was saying, oh, I'm still selling all those groceries and things like that that we were doing out of desperation in lockdown and everything like that. And he said, I'm sure I lose money on every single one of them. Well, I mean, just voicing it is the first step to kind of eliminating it.
It is.
There's lots of larger versions of that, yeah. So saying no is an interesting point of discussion. I guess there's a whole podcast on that. But, you know, the bigger picture of what do great hospitality leaders know and do, you observe lots of people, but you interview them one-on-one in your podcast and through your business experience. You've been one of those people and you've kind of worked with a lot of them too. Well, post-pandemic, we've been through the fire for the last 2.5 years now. What do great hospitality leaders know and do? What's your take on that question?
I'll underline, starting from the outset, I don't think I have the perfect algorithm or answer to that yet. And I never think we're going to answer it, because it's a very individual what they do. But there's some traits they're doing. And then you definitely saw it under the crisis, like the pandemic. You really saw, what I saw was some people that did some very counterintuitive things that then became mainstream things. From the outset, it looked very counterintuitive what they were doing, but they're always doing that. And some of the organization, we knew they would, you know, do the right thing and so on. But actually they very quickly, from a mindset point of view, because they use the word agile in technology, and that's the best acronym. I'm not a very big fan of the word, but I can see how powerful it is, because we can all, it's a bit like the elephant.
It was certainly the word of the moment.
We understand that, but they don't see it as a crisis. They see it as an opportunity. And it's not an opportunity just to rip everything apart and be disruptive. That's not the kind of organization. They went not into crisis mode, but they say, okay, this is a great opportunity. We can't do anything about it. It's not in our control, but we can actually use this time to become stronger and better at what we do, at the core of our business, the soul of our business. That's not changed maybe over decades. Some of these businesses haven't changed the basic of what they do over decades. They maybe changed the way they serve their customers, or the way they build restaurants, or the way they build hotels.
A little bit of menu innovation, a little bit of expansion, but nothing kind of like blowing up. I mean, there's that quote from the economist Schumpeter about the gale of creative destruction, if ever we had that. It was it. And also that other quote, which apparently Obama was told when he took office in the middle of the financial crisis, you know, don't waste a crisis. Now's the opportunity.
But I think it's really the word profit we are not allowed to talk much about, becomes connected with something negative. But at the end of the day, to make a very successful and impactful business, we need to make profit.
You think that's an Anglo? Are you an Anglo construct? Because you talk to American operators and the P word profit is in neon, whereas it seems like... It's just, to do with political background or political culture.
Yeah, and it's very interesting, because you can go out in different parts of the global. It's okay. But exactly, I think also the profit is not bad. It's how we used it. Are we using the as energy to build great organization with happy people that serve great food in when we talk hospitality, or great accommodation to make customers happy and also make a positive impact on their communities with some of that profit they make? Then profitability is great. And we just know, everybody, if we run out of energy or profitability, there's no business. And I think the companies did well, were quite good at making profit that way before they entered into the pandemic. But we all know in general, profitability was dropping across the sector. We had like some big, big systemic issues, I believe, in the sector. And I think they didn't arrive just because the pandemic knocked on the door. They were already there, deeply, deeply rooted.
Okay. So this was these products suddenly on steroids, but the bones of it was already there. Interesting. Yeah, because now it seems like, and like a lot of operators, when there's a drop in profitability or a problem, the first reflex is to cut. and pandemic time was cut staff, cut wage, cut operating costs, hit the landlord for reductions and all those sorts of things. But you're saying that there was something more agile and smarter than that, that these operators...
They were definitely doing that as well, because the reality was that we all were thrown the same challenge. But again, they have also, because they operate, there's some, Justin mentioned a couple of the brands. In the US, there's a company called Singerman's. They did all the things you just said there, but they also, because they had such a strong organizational, cultural foundation, the soul was such in a great place that people very quickly turned things around. They did it together with their people and started creating new revenue streams. But they already had an online shop, for example. They've done that for years. They had 16 different business models within the business, because they hadn't made one business model a couple of a million times. They had six great business performing well in Ann Arbor.
Yeah, I think that diversification is one of the most exciting things that I saw, because I was, who will ever forget 2020? I was running where I was working at the time, running webinars sometimes once a week on the hot issues of the moment. And the ones where we have, I remember one webinar was half a dozen people and all of them were diversifying and all sorts of crazy things. It was so interesting and so exciting, really. And I feel a little bit sad that, you know, once doors reopened, a lot of people just kind of, okay, well, we'll stop doing deliveries and we'll stop doing this. And we're, not entirely, but it was a little bit of back to normal, quote unquote, but not realizing that the customers and the businesses have changed forever.
Yeah, and I think if we take it, you asked me a question before and circled back as well. What is it that they do really well? Of course, they financial control or commercial control is one of their skills. And they have operational skills. They operate on a very high level and deliver some standards. But then they have something to make them special, and that's that ability to, they don't talk about it as culture, but they almost talk about that they have fans. They talk about a future far out from the next 3 years. They have 10-year plans. They have 15-year plans. Singerman's have a 10-year vision they create with their staff every 10 years. And they have relevant business model and diversification into different areas. And often they are able to charge a premium. They are not in the run down on the cost. They're not fighting the race to the bottom of commodities. And their employees, as well as their fans, just love them. They're proud of them. They will buy whatever they put out there. They follow their newsletters and so on. And when it gets tough, their fans sticks with them. And I think we saw that in the pandemic. They just found a different way of selling the experience out of their restaurants or produce. They send groceries or whatever it was. But they continue focusing on the long-term goal and their long-term vision, because they, these kind of organizations, I talked with Ari from Singerman, he said, this is just maybe 2 or 3 years out of a 10-year plan. We can't throw everything out of the pram because we have this bump. We just have to adjust.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. You know, the idea of 3 and 5 year and 10 year plans, it's something very different to most individual operators they have. It requires some confidence about future profitability and time to dream and time to think and time to, yeah, do the kind of planning work with people like you who could, where you could sit around and, yeah, draw on whiteboards and things like that in the best sense of the
word. And I think the interesting thing is that they take that out. It's a habit. They do that and they revisit that vision. And they did that. They also saw the pandemic. This is time to maybe many of these organizations, when I talked with their CEOs and founders, I interviewed one, an interview that goes actually live tomorrow with a founder of, one of the co-founders of Pizza Pilgrim here in the UK, and he talked about this was the opportunity to get back under the hood and really check the soul of the business and our identity, and have we actually gone in the right direction? Were we doing the right thing? And dealing with the things that didn't work from a cultural point of view, and really invested that and understand as we bring our people back, when we do it, what is that we need to do to make them become even better?
Yeah. So let's dig a little deeper on the people side of things, about the new best practice in a way of managing people, whether it's recruitment, skill development, culture, improved productivity, all those kind of things. From all the people that you've been talking about, what are some of the highlights that you've picked up there of what the smart operators have been doing in the last couple of years?
There's no doubt about, we always knew that, and people was one of the key driver that fuels a great hospitality business. I think it become very, you know, clear now with a global staffing crisis that this is the center of any CEO. you talk with right now, how do I actually retain and attract enough people to deliver my promise to customers? And what become very clear is that when we did some research last year, and I thought I was a bit surprised actually, because at that point the staffing crisis was on its highest, up to about still 72% of these people either didn't have a people strategy or they didn't have a clearly defined people strategy.
Wow.
So only up to 28% really operate with a very clear people strategy or people practices. So I think many of these businesses get this right. They are focusing on the fundamentals all the time. What actually make a good job? So making sure that the training's in place, salary in place. And it can sound a bit, but we do all that, people will say. But are you actually delivering it at the highest standards you can?
Yeah. And is there a rock solid consistency about those sort of things as well?
And it's not just something they talk about, it's something they do. And then I think one of the things I've seen, the one that has been really good about this is also about seeing this opportunity to say that, okay, if we want people to stay with us, we need to give them transferable skills. The more transferable skills, we get the more training. And it's not just the training in delivering the hospitality experience of business. It could be how to deal with conflict. It could be how to deal with stress. And you give them more and more of these skills, there's a bigger chance they will stay with you for longer. And it's about buying 1 or 3 months, and you understand that. But you actually buy much more as you give them these skills. And also, one of the things I really thought was really interesting, very dialed down to this, where they're giving them skills, is they involve the best people in delivering some of that. They didn't think, oh, this is impossible. They became a bit more open to using, I've worked with a company that use podcasts now internally to sell their idea and concepts around leadership, values, mission, and they take the best people to come and talk about it from their operation. So it's not about the leaders or somebody external coming to deliver. It's their own friends from the business.
They use the expertise within. Yeah.
So it's knowledge sharing in principle, which I think is going to be a very big thing in hospitality, where the cost of training, and we all know that, and how difficult it is to get people to go on laptops or even do phone training, like people training each other within the industry, because people are quite capable. We have some really smart people in this industry.
Yeah, and all they got to do sometimes is just pick up, you know, the mobile phone and start recording how someone's doing a procedure or something like that, and we've got a 2-minute video about.
But again, I think it starts with that the foundation in place, safe place to work, the right pay, and resources to get the job done, which I think is very hard in the moment, by the way, with supply chain issues and so on. And then the learning bit we just talked about. And then I think there's, what is it that they make people stay? And we all know you don't leave a company. It's an old saying from Gallup. It's not me that's come up with this. You don't leave a company, you leave your boss or your nearest leader or the leadership. So, a very compassionate leadership, which you really need in this situation of where we all felt fear and hopelessness. And so you as a leader really had to become very compassionate.
Yeah, interesting. I remember talking to an operator of a very successful cafe, and her workforce was mostly kind of younger women, students, or that. And she just said in the early days, calm everyone down, and the fear and the anxiety, not about their job security, but just about this disease and this unknown thing. It was just very kind of base level reassurance and leadership she had.
Yeah, and that hasn't changed. We're still in a very uncertain time in many places, even though we're open and maybe revenue is back. But now you are looking at that, how many people are we missing today? What products are we going to miss today?
And customers
were very forgiving, I think, and what I've seen as well in the beginning. But definitely there's also some frustration now I can hear from customers that, oh, again, they didn't have my favorite pizza, whatever it is. And then I think it again comes back to, again, many of these employees also look at this company and see, what is the meaning with I'm here? What purpose does this organization have besides selling restaurant or hospitality experiences? What are they doing beside that? And I think the operator that really worked on, because many of them did something, maybe they did something locally for a school or a football team. You don't have to be that you become B Corp or you do something incredible to save people on the other side of the world, but actually it's that thing where they can connect with the business besides being a job.
Yeah. I mean, shout out to the ordering app, Mr. Yum, which is growing at a rate of knots. And just a week ago, I got an email from them saying, we have a Ukraine appeal with Save the Children, and we're going to match every dollar of donations. Just like, oh, man, wow. I'm in, you know, and I love this organization even more for being so in the moment doing something like that. So what about, you mentioned earlier the businesses that were best placed, of course, to survive the gale of COVID were ones who were already financially strong. But what are you seeing with new best practice with around purchasing, cost control, financial reporting, and all those kind of control systems and use of data? Because we are completely swamped with data. You can pick and choose, but sometimes people, especially the smaller operators, their approach is to just kind of hide their eyes.
And we come back to the profitability here again. The brutal fact is it working. You can have a great culture is hard to build, and it takes a long time. But again, why is it that then it works? What I've seen and what I've experienced myself is that technology is a godsend in today's world. I think there's so many great technology products now that can help you with the transparency of profitability. And if we just go down to cash flow, it's becoming easier and easier for many, many, many operators to understand their cash flow. Which I often have seen, you know, one thing is understanding a P&L, but actually how much money goes in and out and how much you need to survive it's been even more complicated. And technology is solving that. So technology is a very big play in it. But what I actually think is actually a leadership mindset where, and daring not to be scared of sharing this with your people and giving them transparency. There's a great book that was written some years ago in the 80s called The Great Game of Business, where they talk about that whole bottom-up involvement. But the only way you can involve people really in the business and make it better is actually learning them how you make profit in the business and how the business model works. And I actually think many of these companies I talked with maybe didn't do it in that extreme degree. So we were very lucky to interview both Ari from Singerman's and Dave from here in London for Neil's Yard Dairy. And they had for years practicing this, but became even more vigilant practicing this open economy, you can almost say, transparency and all costs.
Yes, open book management.
Open book management is the technical word. And actually, everything is open to everyone. Mm. Everybody can see everyone. It's CEO salary.
Yeah. Everything. So you're seeing more of that happening, people embracing that or the idea of that more?
Yeah, I think in different levels, because for some, opening up salaries will be a very fearful, daunting thing. I totally understand that.
Yeah.
So they've taken it gradually in steps. And it's interesting that the whole philosophy about actually we need to engage people. We need to give them autonomy to make decisions. And the only way you can give people, make them business people in principle instead of employees, is actually involve them in your economy. And it's also...
Yeah, and make sure they're numerate and make sure they have a financial literacy. Interesting article, I put it in the newsletter this week that I picked up on about how people who don't have solid number skills, all of life is more difficult because they're taking mobile phone contracts or borrowing money or working out which item's cheaper than another and those things. And if you can't do that kind of stuff, but then if we expect our store manager to be able to just do, you know, simple calculations around wage cost this week compared to last week, we got to know they can use the calculator on their phone, which sometimes people can't do.
Yeah, so there's actually the basic knowledge of our financial literacy, as you say, but also understanding, you know, lots of technology, you can do the calculation. You just need to understand the outcome and actually how it's connected and working with the business. And of course, what these businesses does open book management really well. It's not an easy journey. It's a marathon. Is they find the KPIs that really runs their business. They don't take the industry approach that labor should be 33%. They find out what labor do we need to deliver at. And I've seen some of these organizations have labor cost at 40%, still make it be very profitable because they're selling an experience.
Right.
Uh-huh. So it's calculated in that we need a labor percent on that level to be able to grow our top line.
They're competing against themselves. They're benchmarking against themselves.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So I think that's really one of the interests of technology and that move over to open book management and actually starting now to see that's critical to actually also retain people. It's about getting autonomy and getting involved in what the hardcore business is to make a profitable business model, because else you're not going to be around and you're not going to make any positive change.
And there's lots of AI is a bit of artificial intelligence, a bit of a mystery to a lot of people. But where I've seen some of these things very helpful, like I know with some rostering software like Tanda's one that I know, it's in UK and Australia, that kind of predictive rostering based on the data that you give it, it can be smarter than you are about whether you're going to be understaffed or overstaffed and where you could possibly pare back. And I'm sure that applies to lots of other data fields as well, where we can apply that kind of magic wisdom to find out what next week and next month's likely to be based on forecasts and history and things.
Yeah, and I think these are great tools, but you still have to do that work where you understand what KPIs really drive the performance.
Which ones matter.
And only you share, you have to share these with your people. And you can make...
Are there any KPIs that you, in your discussions with people, that have struck you as kind of interesting ones, not the usual, obviously, profit figures and per head spends and customer numbers? Are there any others that do? This is a surprise question for you, but I'm kind of curious.
This is like a really, I'm thinking about a guy I interviewed late last year. But the really interesting one he said was that he talks about, with his leadership team, how many of the right people do we have in the right seats? That's the metrics they work on.
So as in staff or as in customers?
In staff and leadership as well. So he asked time throughout the organization, there's one KPI we need to get right to win this battle. Have the right people in the right seats. How many right people? And do we have enough people? On a scale of 1 to 10, do we have enough people? And how many of these are in the right seats? And are they right people? Because if we get that right, all the other things fall together. So that was a very different way of thinking about finance, because he said if you fix that and you improve that, your bottom line would improve. And we have proven that.
You can actually move at a great speed too. There's no friction or impediments really on the people side.
And I think that's a great example of it's a lead indicator. It's a lead indicator, not a lack indicator. So profit is a lack indicator. Sales is a lack indicator. But like, what kind of behavior is it that we need in our organization to win? I think that's a great, analogy of what he says, but probably very hard to live up to. And they probably also have other KPIs they are following. But I think I think it's about coming out of the box and start thinking about your business model as an individual business model. Like, every business is different and you need to discover your algorithm for organizational success and not try to do, because one of the things I did was the way we did P&L in McDonald's is a great example where I failed myself when I went into an entrepreneurial space, that creating a P&L with four term items that nobody can report into really correctly doesn't give sense to talk with the GM about. Talk about the three things he really can drive in his store at that current time. And all the stores was at different levels, because they've been open at different times. And it was very entrepreneurial.
And you had 14 KPIs to confuse things with.
So, and they were very autonomous. So I actually did the mistake, not because that's my leadership style, but I took the autonomy away from them. And that also was one part where I failed and where I had to go back in my learning and say, okay, I need to get them, empower them again. And that was all about giving them responsibility for
more control,
finance performance. Yeah. But that was not like open book management where the whole employees in the front line are involved. It was not on that level. I wish I had that knowledge at that time, because I would have done that straight away.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Let's talk about what's new best practice with the customer experience and service and exceeding expectations. We went from kind of bare bones service at the beginning of COVID, and we were just in there with our favorite places, and we put up with a lot of things, and we started using QR codes and sometimes reluctantly, and understood things were different, but things have changed. Fortunately, I don't know, QR codes, I'm hoping they stay strong, but there seems to be a bit of slip back on that. But what have you seen as new best practice that people have come out with successful operations?
I think, again, it comes, repeating myself, the technology piece has actually become very important for them to, I think some people have found out that the model they did before from a customer experience model has to be reconfigured because they found out actually the model of maybe less service was actually the right model. The customer really didn't value that service they gave or that individual order by detail. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of companies that's got a lot of efficiency out of that. And actually the customer has been given a better experience. I think technology has really progressed really fast there. But I think the big thing is also that some people have found out that what we are about is the human experience and really taking ownership on the hospitality experience. Make sure when they brought that back, they brought it back a bit like when you go on the Southwest Airlines experience. You'll remember that forever and you will come back and again and again. So yeah, I think some people have become much more clear about what they were and didn't try to do. You know, I've seen some have actually dropped out of the delivery market because the real game for them is that. And when you say to your customer you're choosing something, you also, in a way, get the customers, the real fans, to come and often visit you oftener. So, so I think the key thing here is technology really have changed that thing. Some business has become more transactional and some business become more human. And I think there's nothing wrong in both because we all need different experiences. Sometimes we need the transactional because we're on the go. But where I really see a change is also in the way the whole lunch market has changed, where there was a lot of, you know, quick service restaurants or fast casual and to-go market has really changed. And I guess it's the same in Australia where it hasn't really come back. The office worker really drove that sales. So they really need to think now, these brand, how do we do?
Yeah, Monday and Friday are struggle times with a lot of business operators, especially in the city areas.
So they really need to think about how do we actually deliver the brand in different ways. So they've done some at-home things and they continue doing that. But I think, as you said, there's a lot of things they did in the pandemic they are now stopping doing because the profitability and the volume is not there in a way. But I think the real key thing is they've probably been clearer about, the good operators have become clearer about what is that unique experience I want to deliver and actually do one thing well and not trying to run 20 things out of the same unit.
Yeah, And I guess the data, there's now maybe people paying more attention to the things that I've always been able to measure. I mean, I just think of kitchen display screens in kitchen. I'm always fascinated. Well, I'm fascinated, a little bit worried about the number of people who don't use that kind of kitchen technology, but those who do start to see where bottlenecks are and the streamlining that's possible there, which all feeds back to, it's not about rushing customers, but speed of service is just still such a fundamental. Lots of possibilities there I think people are paying more attention to. What about on the areas of marketing, communication with customers, loyalty, social media? I mean, this is a big area, but what have you seen now that people are, with the wisdom of a couple of years, and that are doing better and differently and paying more attention to?
I think this is not what everyone does, but the best of the best are doing. They are, in principle, gone away from looking at their customers again. They're not customers, they're part of their ecosystem, they're part of a community, and they created these communities for them where they can engage with the brand in so many different ways. They could be membership cards. In a small independent operator I know here from the town I live in, have really reintroduced, as we came back into the restaurant, this membership card. There's a loyalty scheme in principle, actually giving you special evenings you can come to, and actually building that community and actually focusing on that community on social media. Email newsletter, been really good at using that because email is a bit of a forgotten tool in hospitality, I think. But the good operator really understand how to write a really great engaging.
I heard it just email described as the diesel engine of marketing, like strong, reliable, always there, not necessarily glamorous, but
but people open it. It's yours. They open it and they read stuff. And I think a lot of operators, the savvy operators, have found out how actually we sit on these databases of people's email they got by consented already to share more stuff. Why don't we start sharing stuff? And it doesn't have just to be product. I think a really good example I've seen is what, again, what I've seen over the Singerman's has done in the US. We've signed up to their newsletter. You can sign up to if you want to hear about their baked goods, their great produce, or the leadership philosophies. You can sign up so many different things. And here the founders has a weekly newsletter where he writes, Ari write about stuff he's experienced in the business and so on. And people want to know that. They want more than the products. They want more than just that, we won an award. Look at our beautiful setting.
Are you seeing more businesses putting, like, that organization stands out, the face of the owners and the founders is they're proud of it and they share it. Do you see more people sharing their personality and their face and their story? Yeah.
I think we probably in hospitality we've been a bit scared for that because it's not about me and there's a lot of humble people as well. And I think it's interesting when the founder starts to put themselves out there and generally authentic people about there's Monica Linton in Judea and she has a restaurant group, a Spanish restaurant group, but she's absolutely fascinated with food from Spain. And when she did a journey around Spain and the BBC interviewed her, and she's also passionate about pulses. And she got I think they got so much noise around that. And they've been around for years. They're 35 years, been.
I think she was on the BBC Food podcast, actually. Now you mentioned. I mean, that's recognition.
That's and she's a mid-sized operator, and I have a retail business and so on as well. But again, she's also their business is definitely in our research an example of also they have a banner where what are they fighting for? They're fighting for better food in the food system in principle. And they're using their restaurant and retail shops to do that. And the founders are out there talking about why it's important to buy better quality food because it's good for you and good for the planet in principle. And I love that because that makes me want to go and buy from them because suddenly I can connect much more with that business. And you get down in the layers you would never ever find on a website. So I think it's like some of them have become podcasters as well. And I think I think you have to find out what works for you. But again, really become experts in their field. And I think that's interesting. And I think you will see more of that.
And maybe out of the drama of 2020 and 21, when people actually had to sort of personally say, hey, this is Ken, we need your help. There's no going back into your shell. I don't know. I always wish more operators would put their face even on the About Us page on their website. Sometimes you wonder, is anyone actually, is there actually people here? But it's something little by little. So it sounds like you're seeing more of that. What about things like Facebook, Instagram, social media? You're seeing they're dynamic platforms that are changing regularly as well. Are you seeing changes the way people are using those, more attention to them or less? Or
I think that we've gone away from just showing dishes of food, which I think is really good in general. And you said something interesting there, when you go in the about stage, because who are these people? People buy from people. And that's it's interesting also see how new operators that comes in, how they actually use social media as a way to build their audience from day one. And maybe all operator will have a channel, but how do they actually engage with it? And how intuitive are they about using this channel? And the transparency, they use it. I think social media now more than ever is about creating transparency around your brand and actually taking these moments that's not polished. It's not a made-up video. It's not a made-up picture. You're grabbing the moments.
A quick story or a quick reel or something.
And I think one of the most, you can call it crazy idea, I call it like the perfect example of giving extreme autonomy and freedom to operate is something called it's a hospitality group in the US. They run hotels and had Mel Miller on, that's the marketing director from them. And she said that when she arrived, she went out to some of the frontline employees she'd seen taking some great photos or grab some moment on the internal comm system and said, would you please just start posting that? Because he's checked out their social profile as an individual and they were very good. Suddenly the frontline employee starts to post about events and what they're doing during the pandemic. And they build up this local community thing because suddenly it's not the marketing team posting, it's individual working for the company that's doing this. And I think that's a really interesting way, again, getting your people involved in actually selling without selling. They're just, in a way, reporting what's happening inside the organization.
Yeah, so there's a kind of democratization of this, like this, that. And it's certainly, what, you know, what I see, I try and follow a lot of operators on Instagram and Facebook, TikTok, whatever. And, yeah, it's that kind of raw, immediate, spontaneous, move on to the next. It's kind of like, I don't know if it's a volume game, but certainly there's got to be a lot of stuff produced all the time, not just one carefully studied piece per week or per month. It's, yeah, three times a day is a good, I was told three times a day on Instagram is a good practice by one marketer.
And then that takes a lot of energy.
Hey, Michael, this has been, it does. Yeah. But if you spread it around, as you say, if you've got a bunch of your staff who this is actually just sort of second nature to them, this is not hard work necessarily. Yeah, it's such a good conversation, Michael. Really enjoying this very much, very stimulating, and just so good to draw on the deep wells of all your experience and all the people you talk to. So tell people where they can find you and make contact and listen to.
The best places to go is the website hospitalitymavericks.com. You can sign up for the newsletter, subscribe for the podcast, find the report I mentioned earlier we did last year as well.
They get a free copy of that. Oh, good. That's there. Yeah.
And there's new episodes out every Thursday, 2 p.m. UK, or British summertime, as it's called now, UK time, GMT. Yeah. So find us there and reach out as well. If there's anything you want to chat about, we're always there to do that. I'm happy to jump on a call.
Terrific. Terrific. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Thanks for joining me. I hope you're feeling inspired after listening to this episode. You'll find the show notes and links for today's episode on your podcast app, and look for the link at the top of the hosporeset.com website. Don't forget to subscribe to the weekly Hospo Reset newsletter and connect with Ken Bergen on LinkedIn and on Twitter.